Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan.
And I'm Josh Fennett. In this episode, we consider the role of women in architecture and design.
Without saying, hey, you know, you're a woman architect, expect it to be tough. Let's go out there with a really positive attitude and say, we are architects. We shouldn't have to say women architects, just like men don't.
We sit down with two leading architects to find out about their work and speak to a journalist about some of the women who have been overlooked in the history of architecture.
All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. So, Henry, I think we've bitten off as much as we can chew with this show. We're talking about women in architecture and design, but I think we owe it to our listeners to explain why we broached this subject. It's always timely when people are overlooked in a discipline, but I think the recent death of British Iraqi architect Zaha Hadid has given us all something to think about.
Obviously, you know, it's always, if you look on the internet, on the architecture blogs, popular architecture websites, there's always a topic which inspires a lot of debate, a lot of strong emotions. But yeah, you know, Zaha really was, I think, someone who left such a profound impact on not only the profession, but I think many related fields and indeed the general kind of world of design and visual culture more generally, that frequently when she was talked about, the fact that she was a woman seemed incidental. And I think that that in itself testifies to her stature.
And we talked to a couple of different architects in this show. Angela Brady is a truly inspiring woman, the director of Brady Malilieu Architects, who I first met 3 years ago at a property fair in Cannes named MIPIM. Those of you who have been before will know what a dreadful, dreadful time it is on La Croisette by the twinkling waters with yachts surrounding you. But she made a very good case for things that should be done for women in architecture and how they're being overlooked. So she's a wonderful, wonderful guest on the show. But we start today's show with a bit of feedback on the news as we heard it. This is me talking to Monocle's senior correspondent, Sophie Grove, about Zaha Hadid.
She was, when I spoke to her too, very forthright and unapologetic. You know, she didn't schmooze journalists, clients, or anyone. She was collecting an award and she was very interesting and kind of gutsy in this wonderful sort of Middle Eastern way. And I think that's one of the things, even though she's now known as a British architect, she had the real spirit of one of those really earthy, big personality, sort of Iraqi, Beiruti style women. There was quite a lot of warmth there behind what was slightly frightening demeanour.
And her career obviously took lots of twists and turns. So she was born in 1950. She studied in Lebanon, moved to London in the early 70s. But it's not until the kind of the mid-90s that she starts to get a bit of recognition. And she was, of course, the first woman to ever be awarded the Pritzker Prize in 2004. But I think latterly in her career, she courted controversy increasingly. I mean, on a number of occasions over the past 2 years with the accusations over people dying actually in the construction of the Qatar 2022 stadium, and then also with the cancelling of the Japanese Olympic stadium. Do you think her untimely demise will force people to, you know, reassess her career and wonder whether she was maybe treated slightly unfairly? She was thrust into the limelight as a star architect, and these kind of modernist, angular, kind of confusing buildings were seen as, you know, building blocks of progress in many countries. Baku, for instance, the cultural centre there. But do you think people will remember her differently to how she's perhaps been portrayed in the media over the past few years?
I don't know. I agree with you to some extent, but I also think that she became quite bitter. And, you know, she had some big disappointments and cancellations early on, like you say, in Cardiff. Her opera house was given the kind of thumbs down, big controversy around that. And then she had a lot of kind of budget issues. And not everyone liked her sort of amorphic sort of spaceship style works. But she did sort of nurture a sort of identity as an outsider, which she quite enjoyed. And even when she was welcomed into the fold and given, you know, a CBE or given a project at the Olympics, she still sort of carried the baton of an outsider. So in a way that fitted her identity. I mean, I don't know what you think, even when she was sort of very much this vaunted British export, she still seemed to kind of want to be slightly on the peripheries.
Completely, completely. But I mean, the other amazing story is the story of, you know, a woman that came here with very little and built a, basically an empire. You know, she's one of these very few architects who is, as I said before, like seen as a symbol of status for developing nations. You know, to have a building by. I recently visited Vienna where she designed an absolutely kind of wonderful campus just north of the Danube for part of the city's university, the economics campus, I believe it is. And it's a really striking building. And you can see a lot of forethought. You can see that, you know, the legacy of these buildings. There is the tumult. There is the reappraisals of the things that she was maybe too forthright about. But actually, a lot of her buildings, you know, the Olympic swimming pool in London comes to mind, will, you know, be remembered as the work of an extremely, extremely remarkable woman.
And she does represent something really interesting, as you say, born in Baghdad. She came, she often spoke of this amazing cosmopolitan culture, mini skirts and, you know, pop music of that era in the Middle East. She was incredibly ambitious and incredibly sort of strong as a woman in that industry, which, let's face it, there aren't that many sort of star architects, to use that term, that really match up to her status. So in a way, despite being complex and controversial, she really has sort of burst through the glass ceiling for women in architecture and actually has made a huge difference to the identity of British architecture also by being a woman.
That was Josh speaking to senior Monocle correspondent Sophie Grove about the life and work of Zaha Hadid. Angela Brady, OBE, is a Dublin-born architect who has lived in London for over 25 years. In 2011, she was elected president of the UK's Royal Institute of British Architects, or REBA, and won numerous awards for her services to architecture and education.
Now director of London-based Brady Malyliu Architects, Angela and co-founder Robin Malyliu specialise in all manner of contemporary and sustainable buildings.
Despite her success, she's an outspoken advocate of getting more women into the industry. We spoke to her in the studio to find out more about the challenges and opportunities facing women in architecture.
Zaha Hadid was our star, our role model. She was a strong woman, and there was no need for her to say, "I'm a woman architect." You know, because that automatically brings in, do men say, "I'm a man architect"? Architects are trained in the same way, whether you're a woman or a man. We have the same skills. But it's the perception of some people that still carry prejudices in this day and age that, you know, it's like people used to think of women drivers. Oh, she's a woman driver. It's just stupid. In medicine and in law, the kind of equality is much better. And I think that maybe it's because they are professions that don't have a male domination. Like on building sites, we're always dealing with contractors. And I think that's great as a woman. It's to my advantage in many ways because I have very good communication skills. And it's very easy for me to get the right finish with a bricky or blocky because they want to be respected as well as I want to be respected.
So do you think women in architecture, actually there's a kind of practical side when you're doing a building that there might be a certain forcefulness associated with being male, whether that's true or not, we can debate till the cows come home. Do you think men are perceived to be better at these things, or do you think that is an attitude which is, thankfully, you know, we're coming to undermine and people are realising that it shouldn't be a male-dominated industry?
It's male-dominated mainly because when women get to the age of having babies, which for architecture is 34 years of age, there's not enough support from their partners generally. And not necessarily their male architectural partners, but from their partners. And I think that until men actually take more responsibility with child rearing, that we're always going to have that problem where women take a couple of years out maybe to have children because the cost of a nanny or a childminder is quite a lot when we are the lowest paid of all the professions. So it's to do with low fees, to do with low salaries, to do with childcare. And that is the biggest obstacle that we women have. And it shouldn't be there.
And you've done a tremendous amount for raising people's awareness and education of this inequality. But I wonder if you can, in broad brushstrokes, tell us how it's changed over the decades since you yourself received your training to today, where we can be a bit more circumspect about the role of women in architecture. What's the trajectory?
There are definitely more women in architecture than there were. When I graduated, we were 10%. We're now 24%, and that's good. not good enough, really. In schools of architecture, we're about 50-50, but there is still the dropout rate, and the same amount of men actually drop out of architecture as women do from the education side. It's also a very good education to be educated for 5 years in architecture, because then you can diversify into many things, from journalism to teaching to other professions in the built environment. Things are changing for the better. We did a wonderful exhibition that went to 34 countries around the world called Diverse City. And our aim was not to moan about being women architects, but to say, hey, we're great. Look at what we're doing. Look at all these fantastic buildings we're designing. And then there was also a little vox pop area on the panels that we had put up. And that was, what are the three things that you want to change? What would you tell younger people coming into the profession if they want to go for architecture? What advice would you give them? Because I think the best thing that women architects can do is help other women architects. But without saying, hey, you know, you're a woman architect, expect it to be tough. Let's go out there with a really positive attitude and say, we are architects. We shouldn't have to say women architects, just like men don't.
So a little bit of it is consciousness raising, but I'm always intrigued by the practicalities of implementing these ideas. So you're a director at Brady Malyoux Architects. You build contemporary sustainable buildings all over London and further afield. What are the practical steps that people who own businesses, who run businesses can do? Is it about taking chances on women architects? Should I not be saying taking chances? You know, is it about just representing women better in the workplace? What are the practicalities of doing so, do you think?
Practicalities are what certainly the big firms, the larger firms who employ over 50 architects, they can have women directors. They can make women directors or associates at an earlier stage on an equal playing field or on equal terms as their male counterparts. And there aren't enough. And one of the reasons is that women architects, it has been shown but from research, women architects don't come forward enough. They don't come forward for pay rises. And the recent AJ Architects Journal survey pointed out that women are paid less than men in many situations in architecture. I think that's totally wrong. It's also against EU employment law. So I would ask people, and when I give talks, you know, all around the UK or around Europe, I say, if you're not being paid, find out what your male counterparts are being paid and ask for a pay rise. If you don't ask, you won't get.
And so during your time as the president of the Royal Institute of British Architects, you would have had a good overview of the working practices right here in the UK. How do they stack up to elsewhere? And are there certain countries that we can benchmark that are doing good work in promoting women equally and giving them the same opportunities as their male counterparts?
I think in Northern Europe, if you look at Denmark or Sweden, Holland, there's a much better equality of women. And I think that we can actually look to them. We have a group called Women in Architecture in Europe, and every June we all get together from about 10 different European countries, and we go and we see the work of women architects, their projects, and it's a great eye-opener to some fantastic innovative projects. But my mantra has been and continues to be, women and men together make better architecture because we have joint skills. And I think that there should be no difference between employing a woman architect or a man architect. We are architects and we have that skill and those good communication skills to make life better, whether it be for schools, homes, hospitals, the built environment. Together, we make the best architecture.
That was Angela Brady, OBE. She's a director of London-based Brady Malyoux Architects and the former president of REBA.
Coming up on the show, we speak to the woman behind the much-anticipated Victoria and Albert Museum extension right here in London.
We also explore the lives of some of architecture's forgotten female heroes.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Needless to say, women have been making significant contributions to architecture and design since the beginning of both professions. Think of Raymond Charles Eames and Charlotte Perriand and Le Corbusier. But as is too often the case in other fields, their contributions are sometimes overlooked and their personalities subsumed by the reputations of their male colleagues.
Nikki Rackard is an architect and writer based in New York who's written about the neglect of women in architectural history on architecture website Arc Daily. He joined me on the line from our New York bureau to discuss the topic.
In the late 1800s, there was a woman called Sophia Hayden Bennett, and she was the first woman to get an architecture degree from MIT. And of course, when she graduated, she couldn't find any work as an architect because people were very reluctant to employ women. So she got work as a drafting teacher. But at the same time, Daniel Burnham was putting together his World Columbian Exposition, and there was a call for entries for designs for the woman's building. And despite being only 21 at the time, she entered a design, and out of a field of 13 entrants, she won. So at the age of 23, they began construction on her first building, and it's not a small building. And that's kind of where the story takes a turn for the worse, because she suffered a lot of micromanagement and interference from various committees involved and invested interests. And she ended up having a nervous breakdown and was kicked off the job. And then from then on, she refused to enter architecture again. So she died having only completed one building. And then another fascinating architect, which I'll admit I'm a little bit biased, there's a woman called Eileen Gray, and she comes from a small town in the southeast of Ireland, which happens to be the same town I'm from. She was born in Ireland and she studied art in London before moving to Paris, where she became known for her lacquer work. And in particular, she did these beautiful lacquered screens, which were kind of architectural in their nature because they divided and made space. And this was kind of her segue into the architectural world. And then later on, her and her lover, Jean Badovici, built this house in the south of France called E1027. And this became kind of her testing ground for a lot of her ideas and her more influential furniture designs. The house got attention from Le Corbusier because on the face of it, it seemed to adhere to the kind of doctrinaire rules Le Corbusier had laid down for modernism, but it actually acted as a foil to them and subverted them in a way that the house was very context specific. And she studied the way that the sun moved across the site and the prevailing wind a lot. So, and the house, she disagreed with the concept that a house is a machine for living, and she saw the house as a living organism itself. Le Corbusier actually bought a site nearby and built a house for himself. And then later on in life, when her and her lover had split up, Corbusier visited the house and vandalized it with a series of murals that he painted on the walls, and again photographed the murals and published them, but never credited her for her work in the designing of the house. And by the 1960s, I mean, Corbusier had become the world-beating architect that we know, and Gray had faded largely into obscurity.
Is it the case that these women who have made unrecognised contributions to architecture are always overlooked in their lifetimes while they're practising? Or are there any examples of women who were celebrated by their contemporaries, but who subsequently have been written out, if you will, of historical accounts of architecture?
Well, it's funny you say that, because a lot of the times, if you look at some of the most iconic architects of the 20th century, like Le Corbusier and Mies van der Rohe and Frank Lloyd Wright and Louis Kahn, often right by their side were very talented women who had a massive influence on shaping their designs, who, despite the best efforts of the architects, or sometimes the architects made no effort at all, but they were never recognized for their contribution. The likes of Marion Mahony Griffin was the first employee of Frank Lloyd Wright, had a massive effect on the development of the prairie style, and she was responsible for those watercolour renderings that became synonymous with Frank Lloyd Wright's style. And then there's another lady called Anne Ting who worked under Louis Kahn and was a very, very close confidant of his and actually had a child with him. And she's described by Buckminster Fuller as Kahn's geometrical strategist.
And finally, Nikki, which woman do you think has been most egregiously overlooked by the architectural community? Whose contributions would you most like to see reevaluated and celebrated?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to pick just one, but there's one particularly outrageous example, which is, of course, Denise Scott Brown. Her and her husband, Robert Venturi, together co-wrote the book Learning from Las Vegas, which became one of the seminal works of architecture and urban planning of the 20th century and really changed the conversation of architects and how they looked at mid-century modernism. And Robert Venturi himself was at great pains to attribute the work to the both of them and not just take credit himself. Except then in 1991, Robert Venturi was solely awarded the Pritzker Prize for both their efforts, and there was no mention made of Denise Scott Brown. And in subsequent years, petitions have been launched to get her recognised as well, but that has yet to happen.
That was Nikki Rackard, the architect and writer based in New York.
If any female architect has burst through this glass ceiling, it's the London-based Amanda Levitte.
Like the late Zaha Hadid before her, Levitte trained at London's Architectural Association. But rather unlike the late Baghdad-born contrarian, Levitte is petite, sunny and unflinchingly friendly, a persona that belies a very steely disposition.
From a mosque in Abu Dhabi to a cultural centre in Lisbon and a restaurant in London's Soho called Tin Can, her practice specialises in experimental, inventive and increasingly ambitious projects. The latest of which is a £41 million extension scheme for the Victoria and Albert Museum, which is to open in 2017.
Our senior correspondent, Sophie Grove, headed down to the site, donned a hard hat, high vis and steel cap boots, and spoke to Amanda about the work in progress.
So Amanda, we're standing in what will be the world's first porcelain courtyard here in the V&A. Just give us a sense of what this space, currently filled with lots of construction and beautiful forms, will eventually look like next year.
So next year, when the new galleries and the courtyard opens, this will have a very particular place. I mean, what we've really worked with is the notion of the iconography of place to create something that's completely particular to the V&A. And so we've designed a courtyard surface made up of porcelain tiles that are parallelograms in shape. We did 2.5 years of research with Tushler Makum to make sure that this tile passed all the regulations, and so we had to add molokite to the mix of the clay in order to make it non-slip and to comply. But the base clay is this very beautiful kind of whitish, almost bluish, very pale grey. And then we have grooves on the tiles, and those grooves, because your foot never touches the surface, we infill with a very glossy, translucent, pale, pale blue glaze. And so the effect will be like a colour field and a visually very complex pattern, but made up of only 6 tile types.
And did you take your inspiration partly from the collection here at the V&A? It's one of the finest porcelain collections and ceramic collections in the world. Was that part of the genesis for the concept?
That was, yes, very much our starting point. We became very obsessed by ceramics on this project. When we were doing the competition, we went round the ceramics collection many times, and there's much use of ceramic in the building itself. There's a wonderful ceramic staircase, and that felt to us the way that we'd be able to create a courtyard that had a certain character and certain colour. But as we developed our research, we discovered porcelain. But in order to make the porcelain work, we had to do all this research. It was porcelain also because the big kind of paradox of this project, if you like, is the big event is invisible, it's below ground. So the kind of conceptual driver for us was, how do you make visible the invisible? And therefore the surface of the courtyard, we wanted to express the kind of palpable energy of the gallery that is below, but to also express the structure that is supporting the courtyard, which is the very gallery ceiling itself. And therefore the pattern of the courtyard and the parallelogram modules of the tiles is derived from taking the geometry of the structure, laying it flat and manipulating it to create this complex but very beautiful pattern.
Tell us briefly about the gates, because that's another really interesting, almost design experiment. Lots of research has gone into creating the structure of the gates, but also really the landscaping of this area is going to change drastically. We're going to have a new entrance taking people from Exhibition Road, which has been a semi-pedestrianised space for some time, but there's going to be a real sense of change in this area.
It was very important for us that this project kind of renegotiated the dialogue, if you like, between museum and street. And so what we're trying to do is take the street into the museum and the museum out onto the street. And part of that was to adapt the Aston Webb Grade 1 listed screen, which used to form an opaque barrier to this lost space. But we've opened it up. But, you know, after 9 months of negotiation with English Heritage and the planners, and we successfully argued for the opening up of the screen, we were then forced with the kind of the irony of actually having to close the screen at night. So how we designed those gates became an incredibly kind of poignant design challenge. And when we commissioned a survey drawing of the screen, the stone screen that we're taking down and then reinstating in its altered form, our clue came because the imprint of the shrapnel damage from World War II was outlined. So we then set about to develop a piece of software that would calculate the different angles of perforation, multiple different angles of perforation, so that from certain vantage points in these new gates, which are 25 millimetre thick slabs of aluminium, anodized aluminium, through which you can still see the courtyard, but from a certain vantage point, because of the multiplicity of the angles of perforation, you will be able to read the trace of the outline of the imprint of the shrapnel damage. So that became a part of the narrative of memorialising absence, and it's a little bit like making visible the invisible through the way that we treat the courtyard and the way that we conceptualise an oculus which looks down into the gallery below, and where you can read the structure of the gallery, but it is the structure that supports the courtyard. So it gives a very didactic reading of architectural intent.
Just finally, I wondered if you could reflect on, I mean, we were talking briefly earlier about how this new extension is so subtle in its forms and all the concepts, the very interesting design experiments going on here, really taking some of the themes of the museum into the space. But I wondered, does this mark a departure for museum designs? It isn't such a splash, it isn't such an egotistical building. Do you think that that is a significant departure for London and for the V&A?
I think what was so interesting about our brief, because if you remember some years ago, the idea was that Libeskind had designed a building that was quite bombastic in its form. And when, for a number of reasons, that didn't happen, the V&A, and this, I think this is a very interesting and very brave move that they took. They just stepped back for a number of years and reflected, and then decided that actually it wasn't about a big visible moment. It was about creating a public space in London and about doing something below ground. And for me, in a way, the kind of demise of the Libeskind scheme, if you like, marked the end of building as icon. And so what we've tried to capture in the way that we've conceived this scheme is the iconography of place. And I think for me, one of the kind of successes of the scheme will be when the courtyard that we've created becomes a destination in itself.
Monocle's Sophie Grove there, speaking to Amanda Levitt about the extension to the Victoria and Albert Museum in London.
And sadly, that's all we have time for in this week's show. My thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, our senior correspondent, Sophie Grove, and the show's producer, sitting right opposite me, twinkly-eyed, bushy-tailed, is Henry Rhys Sheridan.
If you've got any comments or queries about the show, then feel free to drop me an email at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at Monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes, and please do leave us a review while you're there, letting us know what you think of the show.
You've been listening to Section D, and I'm Josh Fennett.
I'm Henry Sheridan. Thanks for listening, and until next time, it's goodbye from us.